Bob's Earth Explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Tonight is July 27, 2008. My AccuWindow forecast is 90 plus and dry and windy in the upper desert of eastern Washington state near the Canadian border. Interesting things happening this week. Hollywood has had its best week ever. Ever. More great movies have come out in the last month than ever before. Interesting thing about it is none of the ones that are really making money, are R-rated. We're going to have the phone lines open all night tonight, so you can call in toll-free. We'll announce it every 30 minutes tonight, so if you miss the phone number, hang around for half an hour and write it down again. U.S. and Canada toll-free, 888-228-4494. Canada, we have a toll-free number just for you, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us by dialing 530-776-5154 or 5185. You Skype users, we didn't leave you out. You can dial us up at BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at bbsradio_com. Now, if you're using Magic Jack, make sure to use that 530-776-5154 number. And that's what we're coming to you live on tonight, is Magic Jack. We like the product. Tell us how you think we sound tonight. The solar wind tonight is a mere 422.6 kilometers per second. And the proton count is up a little to 5.7 protons per cubic centimeter. Again, the sun is blank. Solar cycle number 24, a no-show. And the solar wind is barely streaming from a coronal hole. Not much chance of an aurora borealis if you believe the sun is responsible for such. But you might want to duck. Plasma bullets are zinging past Earth. That's the conclusion of researchers studying data from NASA's 5 Themis spacecraft. You'll remember last February 2007, they launched the Themis probes. It's a single nose cone that had 5 satellites in it. They're in position, and they say gigantic bullets are launched by explosions one-third of the way to the moon. And when they hit Earth, wow, the impacts spark colorful outbursts of northern lights called substorms. The Themis fleet is designed to unravel the mystery of substorms, which have long puzzled observers with their unpredictable eruptions of light and color. The spacecraft wouldn't merely observe substorms from afar. They would actually plunge into the tempest using onboard sensors to measure particles and fields. Mission scientists hoped this in-situ approach would allow them to figure out what caused substorms, and they were right. Or so the leaders of the Themis project have claimed. The discovery came on what began as a quiet day, February 26, 2008, not long ago. Arctic skies were dark, and Earth's magnetic field was still. High above the planet, the 5 Themis satellites had just arranged themselves in a line down the middle of Earth's magnetotail. This is a million-kilometer-long tail of magnetism pulled into space by the action of the solar wind. That's when the explosion occurred. A little more than midway up the Themis line, magnetic fields erupted, releasing about 10 to the 15th joules of energy. Now, a joule is a watt second per square centimeter, so you get the idea how much energy is released. The scientist's name was Angelopoulos. He says, for comparison, that's about as much energy as a magnitude 5 earthquake. Although the explosion happened inside Earth's magnetic field, it was actually a release of energy from the sun. Now, how they come up with this conclusion is a little beyond me, but hear me out. When the solar wind stretches Earth's magnetic field, it stores energy there in much the same way energy is stored in a rubber band when you stretch it between thumb and forefinger. Bend your forefinger and crack. The rubber band snaps back on your thumb. This is also called a Higgs event. If you want to discuss that further, we'll talk about it some more tonight. Something similar happened inside the magneto tail on February 26, 2008. Overstretched magnetic fields snapped back, producing a powerful explosion. This process is called magnetic reconnection, and it is thought to be common in stellar and planetary magnetic fields. Well, doesn't it make sense, then, that it was actually the Earth's magnetic field that caused the aurora borealis? I'll state my case a little more clearly here in the first hour when we discuss this in depth. The blast launched two plasma bullets, gigantic clouds of protons and electrons, one toward Earth and one away from Earth. The Earth-directed cloud crashed into the planet below, sparking vivid auroras observed by some 20 Themis ground stations in Canada and Alaska. The opposite cloud shot harmlessly into space and may still be going, for all researchers know. The Themis satellites were perfectly positioned to catch the shot. We had bullseyes on our solar panels, says Themis Project scientist David Seebeck of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Four of the satellites were hit by the Earth-directed cloud, while the opposite cloud hit the fifth satellite, which was further out into space. Simple geometry pinpointed the site of the blast between the fourth and fifth satellite, or about one-third of the way to the moon. So, for the first time, Themis has shown us the whole process in action, from magnetic reconnection to aurora borealis, says Seebeck. We are finally solving the puzzle of substorms. The Themis mission is scheduled to continue for more than another year. And during that time, Angelopoulos expects to catch lots more substorms, dozens of them, he says. This will give us a chance to study plasma bullets in greater detail and learn how they can help us predict space weather. Themis is not finished making discoveries, believes Seebeck. The best may be yet to come. Now, we'll talk about this just a little bit. And remember that our phone lines are open. You'll know that in the last 5 years there have been two photographs of Earth from space showing aurora borealis over both poles at the same time. This is the main reason why Themis was launched in the first place. First, to understand why they dance and flow in the atmosphere, or what seems to be the atmosphere visible from the ground, but also to understand their origin. Because over the decades, as we collected data and started doing statistical analysis, for instance, today we have an aurora borealis. What is the solar wind? What is the Earth magnetic field strength? What happened was, as they drew correlations between the two, is they didn't find any. We were getting aurora borealis over the North Pole when there wasn't any appreciable solar wind. We were getting Antarctic aurora borealis, even though the South Pole was not in the solar wind at the time, which means they were caused by Earth magnetism. So in order to dispel the myth that it was caused by the solar wind crashing cosmic radiation into the upper atmosphere, they launched the Themis probes. I thought it was pretty aggressive and pretty open-minded of NASA to fund and launch this set of probes. However, to align these and claim, or at least create the idea that plasma bullets are somehow stored up invisibly out into space and suddenly explode into creation just because they appeared between the fourth and fifth satellites that we saw, this is kind of a logical explanation for them. What could be happening is an interaction between dark matter and the magnetic ropes that connect Earth with the Sun. That's one explanation. The other is the counter-rotation of the Earth's core and its crust create high-velocity magnetic flux lines that come out of the north and south poles of the Earth. These can reach such velocities to accelerate particles that when they strike oxygen particles high in the atmosphere, they cause them to glow. I believe we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, this is Tony from Alberta, Canada.
How are you, Tony? Welcome to the program.
I'm great. How are you?
I received
your third book, your autographed book.
Oh, great.
The only thing I didn't receive any link to download any of the audios. How do I get that?
Well, we sent them out twice to the people who bought the third volume, and it might have ended up in your spam folder. If you'll go to, and I'll go ahead and post this link at X Squared Radio at the end of August 2nd, but you're going to have your receipt to get in there because this offer is only good to August 2nd for those people who bought the book like yourself. So I'll give you the link verbally. It is simply archofmillionsofyears.com, mm-hmm. and then it's /A audio_chapters. Yeah, /audio_chapters, and then capitalize the A and
C. Audio chapters?
Chapters, plural.
Chapters.
.html.
.html? That's it?
Yeah, like hypertext machine language.
Yeah, HTML. Okay, that's great. Yeah, what I wanted to... I was wondering if I could ask you something. I listened to Seda Talk. Is that real, or is that just... have you heard about that? They talk about Planet X all the time. Hello? Hello? Hello?
Sorry about that, Earth Explorers. We don't know why we got disconnected. Could be
okay.
The magic of...
Okay, I'm still back day. On.
Okay.
Okay, I wonder what your thoughts are on Seda Talk. I listen to that quite often, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I don't really pay much attention to Seda Talk, but from what I understand, they're kind of 2012 forward-looking group, but they kind of concentrate on the negative side of it, and we try to concentrate on the positive side of it. The three volumes that we wrote, it's almost impossible to not, you know, paint a picture of doom and gloom, because that's what all the ancients have been doing for 4,000 years, or almost 5,000 years in our writings.
Right.
So that's why in Volume 3 we separated the book into two parts, so that the first part would be, would sort of finish the story of 2012 and the end times and mm-hmm. what all the ancient populations and civilizations had predicted to come to pass. And then Part 2 was a positive message of consciousness and how we can actually affect the outcome of those cataclysms.
Yeah, I haven't got to that point. I read the first part, which was quite interesting, and you know, all the historical items that you found, you know, and it showed that 2012 was always kind of in there, and in the scriptures it kind of mentions wormwood and different things like that, and destroyer.
Mm-hmm. In volumes 1 and 2, we go into the physics of it. We talk about supermassive black holes and time warps, mm-hmm. and it's quite interesting. And when we came out with volume 3, we were really afraid that people wouldn't have volume 1 and volume 2, so we recorded the two volumes,
okay.
and then stuck them on the website so that people could listen to the first two volumes and then read the third volume and they'd have it all.
Oh. Yeah, that's what when I talked to you at the beginning, that's what I was saing. I was looking for that link, to get those audio ones, because I got the book, you know, and it's the autographed book I got from you, and it's very interesting. And so I was wondering on this energy thing. I've been reading about this water for gas. Is that reasonable? Can that be actually work?
Yeah, it's pretty good technology. Basically, it works on low power electrolysis. It splits the oxygen and hydrogen atoms apart from the water molecule. It routes the hydrogen to the intake, mixes it with gasoline, and hydrogenates the intake so that you get more power, more mileage. Now, there are vehicles out there that don't run on gasoline at all. They only run on the water. The problem is that they can't do the electrolysis fast enough to keep up with a driving vehicle, so usually they have to store the hydrogen for a while to give the car a little bit of a boost. You'd have to have a tremendous amount of power and some, maybe even a catalyst to get the oxygen and hydrogen apart and then recombine them in the engine. Couple that with the fact that now you have water vapor going through your whole engine, you're probably going to corrode the whole thing.
Would that hurt the engine?
Yes, it will.
It will, eh? Okay, that's what I was wondering, you know, if that would actually hurt the engine. You know.
Yeah, you'd almost have to have a complete aluminum and stainless steel engine to be able to hold up to just straight water vapor inside of it. However, the hydrogen-enhanced combustion is a viable technology, and there are lots of new up-and-comers that are trying to get into mass production with that.
So what is your think? I got the book, but what do you think about this Planet X? Is there such a planet out there that's coming this way that's going to cause us problems?
Well, if there is,
I've read so much about that.
If it's out there, it's impossible for us to see at this time. But there is evidence on Mars, Saturn, and also on Earth of a close path by an intense gravitational body at some time in the past. It fractured the surface of Mars, stripping its atmosphere off, probably stripped quite a bit of the atmosphere off of Earth, caused the seas to leave their bounds by several thousand feet. There's evidence of that on the Earth as well. So will it happen again? That's a great question. If it is heading our way, we just can't see it with our telescopes from here. It may be behind a black hole, it may be in another dimension, and then again, it just might be on the other side of our sun.
Mm-hmm. So didn't NASA back in 1992, they discovered something and then they never heard about it again? They were talking about some large object that they...
Yeah, there was a very, very small, actually it was a large asteroid, hardly could be considered a planet, but it was in orbit around our sun, and it was a kind of a peculiar orbit in that it wasn't in the same flat plane that the other nine planets revolve in. It was rather skewed to that.
I see.
But that would be, you know, kind of like you know, two bodies traveling at right angles to one another, coming close to one another, the odds of that would be gazillions to one.
The other thing I was wondering, you know, your book says about that Earth has got, like, there's a spiritual part and there's a physical part.
Correct.
How can that be? You know, it's just, you know, it's, are they separate entities or?
That's a real great and a real common question. We can approach it two ways. Suppose you have a 5-gallon bucket and you fill the bucket as full of glass marbles as you can get it. It's full. I mean, you couldn't get another marble in it. Now
right.
Pour a couple gallons of water in the bucket.
Right.
You now have two forms of energy, one liquid and one solid, occupying the same container.
Right.
Look at your human body. Your calcium and protein and iron and manganese in the form of a human body, but that's not really you, Tony. I mean, the Tony on the inside, the animated Tony, is a spirit energy, another mass that occupies the same space as your body. The Earth is the same way. It has two forms of energy that make up its shape.
You're saying something in the book that they're going to come apart. Like one's going to leave. Is it actually going to leave? I mean, is it going to leave this Earth completely? And what will be left of this Earth if one part leaves?
Well, according to the ancients, they described a process which we call the union of the polarity. It is the combination of two different bodies into one body. Nowadays, we call it like a binary star or a binary planet. So Earth is a binary planet. However, for several thousand years, the two bodies have been operating in almost perfect harmony. Now, as we're getting closer to the black hole, or at least closer to the extremely powerful plane of gravity that comes out of the black hole in the center of our galaxy, the two bodies are beginning to become dissonant to one another. They're not in harmony anymore. They're beginning to wobble against each other.
So why aren't they in harmony? Is it because of the vibration? Or?
Yes, it's because of the vibration. And it may be something that's not avoidable. And if the two Earths come apart, it's said, at least by the Mayans, in the clearest language that we can find, that the spirit Earth is going to come apart from the physical Earth and is going to go into another dimension. Some say the fourth dimension and some say the fifth dimension.
Right, I heard that.
All life that resonates with that Earth is going to go with it.
So people, you're talking people here.
I'm talking people, animals, plants. Matter that resonates with that Earth is going to leave.
So how would you resonate with that spiritual part? How would you bring your vibrations up?
That's a really great question. There are some assumptions that are made, especially when you go back into the Zohar and a book that's called the Sefer Yetzirah. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that exactly right, but that's the way it's spelled. It's the oldest book in the Zohar. It talks about a 10-dimensional structure of matter and also of humanity. And it said that if you can bring up the consciousness or the enlightenment of the soul, and this is done through, of course through meditation, but it's also done through love and not through hate, not through fear. It's sort of an ascending process of leaving behind greed and wickedness and violence and gravitating more toward love and togetherness and charity. This has a tendency to bring up the level of light inside of a person. That's how you resonate with the higher Earth.
Is that like caring for other people instead of so much for yourself?
Yes, of course. And now that doesn't mean not to love yourself. That's actually the primary goal. If you can get to where you love yourself, then it's quite easy to love others.
True.
If you hate yourself, it's almost impossible. It is impossible to love others.
Right. I've just listened like 7 hours of a tape that was called Down the Rabbit Hole. I don't know if you've heard of that one. This
wow, sounds like a very familiar title. One of my friends, John Riley, uses that term all the time.
Yeah, it's a bunch of PhDs and you know, some Enlightenment people, and they talk about reality and different things like that. And I just listened to it, and I just wondered what your thoughts were on something like that. I mean, they're talking that there's really nothing out there. It's all we don't really.
Well, that kind of sounds like a challenge. You know, it's kind of like saying, well, there's nothing out there. What they're really saying is, if you're out there, please make yourself known to us. And that's kind of a scientist's way of saying, you know, we dare you to present us data. So I wouldn't put too much stock in that. I guarantee you
deep,
we're not alone in the universe.
Right. It was very deep, and it was, it was a lot of, it was like 7 hours on a CD. And someone gave it to me, and I started listening to it. And I was just wondering about it, and I thought, well, I'll just call the expert here, Brooks. It's so expert on everything, it's, and I just, I knew you'd be able to, put some insight into it.
Well, I know
I listened to your show every Sunday, and I just enjoyed immensely. You have an excellent show.
I really appreciate it.
You do, and you have some good guests, but even when you don't have a guest, you explain everything so well that, I never miss you, and if I do, I get you in archives, and
that's fantastic.
Information and you're preparing us, and I think that's just fantastic. And I probably should let you go because there are probably other callers.
All right, Tony, you make sure to call us back again.
I sure will. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Good night. Well, that's what we're here for. I wanted to thank you all formally. For the last month, X Squared Radio has been the number one director of listeners to BBS Radio, our network. And I just want you to know how much I appreciate that. We only have one webpage for the radio station. That's x2-radio.com. We do publicize it a little bit, but mostly it's word of mouth. It's you out there listening, telling a friend that there's something else to do on Sunday night between 5 and 8 p.m. Pacific, and that's listen to X Squared Radio. Those people have gone to our website, have clicked on the BBS Radio banner, and have gone to listen to other hosts, which we greatly appreciate. Number one last month and number two the month before that. We appreciate you more than you know. We come to you live each week on bbsradio.com. We also come to you live on the Steel Eye Media Network, courtesy of my friend Kevin Smith. Now, if you live in a town where you would like to hear BBS Radio or X Squared Radio on your AM station, we can rebroadcast, or we can simultaneously broadcast on AM. So if you know the call letters of that station and you would like us to contact them, go ahead and write us at info@x2-radio.com and we'll pass it along. Just by way of really quick commercials, we have had a tremendous amount of response in the last 2 months, and I just want you to know how much we appreciate it. You probably own an inkjet printer. I own a couple of them. And I used to buy my inkjet cartridges at a national chain store, and they cost about $35 per cartridge. I know the color and the black cartridges together run about $80. Well, no more, because I discovered a great place to buy printer supplies at 123 Inkjets. They not only provide excellent quality and fast shipping, sometimes the shipping is free, every time I buy, I get a chance to win a free printer. Now, how cool is that? I know that they're getting ready to start their back-to-school specials, and it is amazing. They have toner, they have printing supplies, CDs, DVDs, all those things that you need for high school or college. So click on the 123 Inkjets banner at X Squared Radio today and start saving money. You'll be amazed at the difference. Also, the PERSIDs, the one of the most prolific meteor showers that occurs each year, is getting ready to start. It's pretty fantastic to get out there and watch it. And as we approach this stream of debris from the comet Swift-Tuttle, those are the two people that discovered it, by the way, both amateurs, the source of the annual PERSID meteor showers, the first contact with the stream comes in the waning days of July, which is where we are now. At first, only a few meteors per hour will flit across the night sky, but as Earth moves progressively deeper into the stream, the shower intensifies. Forecasters expect the PERSIDs to peak on Tuesday, August 12th, with a flurry of dozens at backs on top of our sleeping bags, and it was amazing. So if you want to get out there and see that, tonight they're going to start, and they're going to peak in about 2.5 weeks. We have a caller on the line. Your first name and where you're calling from.
This is Dottie, and I'm calling from Arizona.
Hi, Dottie. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you. I, too, like the earlier caller, just received your book, although I haven't read it yet. I've started reading it, but I am not far enough along. But there's a very, I think that you have also said that we're at the end of a 25,000-year cycle.
Yes.
Haven't you said that before? That
right.
There are 12 ages, and then each age is a little bit more than 2,000 years. And that the Earth goes through, just like people do, an end of a cycle and a rebirth. And I think with planets, it's the same as it is with people, the microcosm it is with planets. And this planet is going through just what people go through when they come in and out of form and have a new life.
I'm sorry, I missed the last thing that you just said.
Well, it's almost
what
like
was the last
people,
thing?
You know, that we go in and out of form, seeking expression,
right.
Learning. And then at the end of that human life, you know, we leave the body behind and the soul hopefully moves up into the next plateau. either the next rung of the ladder of the kingdom that you're in, or even better, to the next kingdom. And so I think that's true with planets and solar systems and universes. They keep growing. They keep perfecting, and they keep moving on. And with a human life, it's usually within 100 years. But I think with planets, that is the 25,000-year cycle. And we're at the end of that last age, the Piscean Age. We're at the end of a 25,000-year cycle. And we're going to experience this separation of the soul from the form, which is the planet, the material. And I think that might help your earlier caller in kind of visualizing, if they can imagine what happens to a human, also happens to a planet, happens to a solar system, happens to a universe, and that all of the metaphysical writings talk about this. You know, it's a life within a life within a life, a world within a world within a world, and
right.
We are, everything is growing and moving, and because it's alive, it's a life form.
Well, that's interesting that you should say that, because it is, you know, a lot easier for us to understand. It's made up of two different kinds of matter. when we look at our own bodies, because we, you know, we're not this blob of water and muscle that's, you know, moving around the planet. We're the being inside. So if the Earth has whatever personality or whatever spirit is inside planets, then it must also be alive. It's an organism upon which we live and with which or with whom we have to live in harmony.
It also has an ensouling life. Each of the planets has a life force of which we, you know, enjoy living with. And I
do you think it's a harmonious relationship that lives on the surface of the Earth and the Earth itself right now?
You know, I don't, because this is considered one of the non-sacred planets, because it's still personality-focused rather than being soul, S-O-U-L, infused. So this planet has a lot of problems. And then in the works that I have read, I prefer Alice Bailey's writings and those that are really from the Tibetan. They talk about this as being a non-sacred planet, and that it is really very young, and it's and that everybody who is here are rejects from other rounds, and around is 12 ages, and we're right at the end of 12 ages, so the separation is going to happen again. And we, who were rejects from before, can either move forward with the soul aspect of the planet, or we will be left behind to start over again, because we have
this
a great opportunity.
Consider this, Dottie, though. If right now, let's just make a general assumption that there are more human beings alive on the Earth today than have ever been here before. And if we're being recycled or reincarnated over and over again on this Earth, then that means that up until now, most of us have been in some disembodied state. However, consider the fact that maybe we're very close to all of the bodies, all of the humans that are assigned to this Earth, having a chance to be alive many, many times. And that maybe now, as Earth is nearing this transition state, this state where it's about to go through this paradisaical shift, that perhaps some elders are being sent here or volunteering to come here to teach and to show others how to become enlightened beings, not to let us stumble on our own. For instance, I don't think Jesus was a reject.
I believe that completely. You don't think he was a reject?
I don't think Jesus was a reject.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah,
no,
I don't think Buddha was a reject.
People from the next kingdom. Well, in what I believe, and I kind of came in knowing this, and then I finally found it. I've, you know, written in Alice Bailey's was Blavatsky, too, but Alice Bailey was almost the same mental type I am, so I was able to understand her better. So I gravitated to that. But there are people from, we're considered in the fourth kingdom, and the first is the gaseous and the mineral, the second is the plant, the third is the animal kingdom, the fourth is the human, and the fifth is what we call the kingdom of God, but there's a sixth, a seventh, an eighth, a ninth, a tenth, 11th, and a 12th. So I'm sure that just like we reach down to the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom and take care of them, so too do advanced souls from the kingdom of God or the fifth kingdom reach down and help us. Or at least I hope that they do, because have met people who have made me a better person.
How do you envision that reaching ships, or do you think they're born here?
I think that they can come two ways. I think that if they're really advanced and they're really from that causal realm, C-A-U-S-A-L realm, which is the soul realm or the higher realm, I think that they can either appear and do what they want to do, or they can come into a life form in order to just walk among us and not be known who they are. And I think there are many, and you might be one of those people, because I think you're very advanced in your thinking. I think you're very advanced in your writing. And I think you're really trying to help give out really good information that's backed up from lots of different sources. I think that's what I love about you, is that you don't just name one source. You name many sources that are saying the same thing. And I think that is true, that all the religions are really teaching the same thing. It's the same God. We might worship him differently, and we might, because of our level of mental awareness, where we live in the world, you know, our own point of evolution, we're going to be attracted to a religion that teaches us what we now need to know, but that it's the same source. And if you go back to the source, they're all saying the same thing. They're trying to teach us by telling stories, some basic principles. They always say, if you want to convey something really important, tell a story. And I think
that's
all
been done since the age of the Gnostics.
That's all the Bible.
Allegorically.
Right.
Teaching
and I think
by story or teaching by allegory.
Right, and so that's what all of those books from, you know, thousands of years ago, 2,000 and 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, and maybe more, I think that that was how they taught.
Well,
you know,
one of the things I wanted you to give me some feedback on, you mentioned that higher beings or enlightened beings or shall we call them elder creatures could come to this world two ways. One is to, mm-hmm. you know, assume the form of a human and walk among us and try to teach us from within. And the other, maybe more ostentatious, is to arrive in a ship or show up as an angel or an orb or some kind of
plasmoid. I don't think they need a ship.
And give us a feeling.
I think they can just descend. I think they need a ship. You know, those that belong to our kingdom. There might be people from other realms that might use ships to get here, but we're all part
yeah,
of the
exactly.
form. It's just the next stage up, you know, of where we hope to go, and we're connected with them. We're truly connected because people can actually tap into that intelligence. Some people call it what I think you called it, the Akashic Records, and I know of it as the Akashic Records, but I think there is a record, if you can tap into that mental. They say that you have to tap into it through your own soul. That if you're going to be a high-level clairvoyant, you're tapping into that, your soul that can tap into the master life, you might say, that surrounds all of us. And
right,
that information is available. So if you have a good connection with your own soul, if you're more soul infused rather than personality focused, you'll have a really good path to that information. But other people that go into the astral realm, that's kind of where there's illusion and delusion, and that's where a lot of psychics go. And that's not really a very good place for information.
Yeah,
and
all.
So depending on how advanced you are, and you are
material
advanced,
for one thing. You know, sourcing the material for one thing, and then your audience, if, you know, what they say about a prophet in his own land isn't really considered very wise at all. Oh, that old Jesus from Nazareth, we know him. So there are challenges every way. And yet, you're born into this world, you lose touch with all of your past memories and experience for a number of years, around age 8 or 9, or even up in early teens, people start making connections with their previous self and start pulling forward this previous experience so that they have wisdom beyond their years. So this all comes with challenges, which we overcome.
Right, and I think the more intuitive you are, the more you can tap into that. I know my mother came into this world knowing how to play the piano, even though she had never had a lesson in her life. Both hands, she was very gifted. And she was just re-remembering. she still had that. She was able to tap into that memory. And I think others come into this world. It's almost like you were saying when you were interviewed on George Norrie that you kind of come into this world with a purpose. And you're really tapping into knowledge that you came here to convey. Or, you know, you really do have a purpose. And there are many great people who have come who are trying to help, especially now because we are in the last hours, or, you know, as far as planets go, as we go through the end of this age. I think we started into the Aquarian age with the discovery of electricity. So we've been cusping now for more than 100 years. Things really changed. I remember my grandmother talking about, she remembered just, you know, barges being pulled up rivers with mules, and then she also saw a man on the moon. And that was just in her lifetime, and that's because we went through that, out of that age of illusion and disillusionment, which is the Piscean age, into what I hope is a brighter future for all of us. And I think some of us because we have karma, we're supposed to help.
That's a real interesting observation that, you know, it wasn't just when your mom was a child. We're talking about the last years of humanity. We've been pulling barges up the river with the mule. And only the last 100 years has this changed. Why has it changed? What changed in the last 10,000 years to allow this to happen? It wasn't Edison. It wasn't Tesla. Tesla received the same information that Tibetans received in the 7th century. It's the beings that are coming to the planet. That's what's changed. It's the age and the wisdom and the experience of the beings that are coming here.
And I think at a great sacrifice. I think a lot of them have really sacrificed coming here. And did it because of their love of humanity and trying to bring as many souls along as possible in a very short period of time. I think there's just this short window of opportunity where we can come and help, or maybe you could, maybe I'm one of the people being helped. But I think that's true.
I don't want you or anyone else to get caught into the cycle of sacrifice, and I'll tell you why. It isn't really a sacrifice to come here, which it's our dream. It's what we want to do. And to sacrifice for another person isn't really a compliment, to tell you the truth. You're telling that person
that they can't do it. I'm just talking about it's a sacrifice to descend into matter, that it's really hard to do that. And you have to have a great deal of love in your heart to do that.
Yeah.
To leave the fifth kingdom and come back to the fourth, where there's so much evil in this world, there's really tremendous. I have never seen more signs of a demonic influence as I have really in the last, since the Second World War. I think it's been coming on slowly with each generation having little morals and the breakdown of the human family, you know, children that are raising themselves. You know, it's really a tragedy what's going on. And there are a lot of young souls here who are just truly lost and have kind of stepped the wrong way. I think they have entered darkness. And with their behavior and the drugs, and I think it creates a path. And I also think today it's almost like with the elections, you know, it's very interesting what's going on. You have three different generations that were, you know, vying for positions. I don't think that the Democratic, I think something's going to happen during the convention that Hillary Clinton, it really isn't out of the race yet, because every time that Obama's kind of like the guy that a lot of young people really liked, but after you date him for a while, all of a sudden, you know, he keeps revealing himself. And I think that's something that happened during the convention because of just that. And then McCain is older, you don't know. He certainly is the man that we know. You know, he's like the grandfather that we've known all our lives. You know, we feel very comfortable with him. And Hillary Clinton was a great opportunity for women. She was right in the middle. She used to be the president of a Young Republicans Club when she was in college, and she was a Goldwater girl, and then because of human rights, of all things, she switched over to the Democratic Party. So she's kind of in the middle. And then also with regard to Senator McCain, the same thing. You know, he reaches over to the Democrats when he thinks it's best for all the people. So you have two people that were in the middle, three generations. You know, it's very interesting what's going on. And
well,
I
kind of think it's a non-issue. I mean, it's great for the news,
yeah.
And I know it gives the cable channel something to do, but we don't really have a government per se. We have a coalition of bureaucracies that manage to work together with a common currency and some semblance of a constitution, but there's no really one mind of government. It's so duplicitous that you couldn't get anything solid out of it if you wanted to. So we don't really talk about politics on this program, and that's the reason. Because it's kind of a non-issue.
I'm just saying that these are very testing times. I think that people are being judged by not only what they do, but who and what they're attracted to. I think judgment has commenced.
Sure.
And
you'll know a man by what he laughs at.
Political election, right? And it kind of reminds me of Maya Angelou once said, "When somebody tells you who they are, believe them." And that's what people are not doing. You know, they're not paying attention.
You know what it boils down to, Dottie? It boils down to whether people remember their dream or not.
What is your dream?
What is my dream? I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm actually living my dream. I'm creating new energy sources. I'm building things. I get to talk to interesting people every single week. I get to write books. I get to travel. I'm doing what I always wanted to do, and I am what I always wanted to be.
Oh, that's wonderful. That really is, that you're fulfilling that. I think that's very important.
I think it's vital to the human experience. And I ask people that all the time, especially people that I see in various states of despair. What's your dream? And they go, oh, that. Gee, I haven't thought of years. And, you know, to get them thinking about it again and get them out of their rut, out of living from paycheck to paycheck or family vacation to family vacation, and getting them thinking about what it was that really excited them about growing up in the first place when they were kids.
Well, it really is. I think, did you say it? It was the best of times, the worst of times, and what was it, the right time?
It could be. Heaven is right here. Heaven is not in the sky. It's not out there somewhere. It's right here. All you have to do is turn it on.
Oh, you know, one other thing. Actually, I wrote you an email about this. But in your book, you kept talking about the year 2012. And a lot of what of your writing really does lead down that path of trying to make people aware that we are at the end of the age, and with the Mayans and others, the calendar. And also in your book, I got about into 50 pages of it, and you have some maps of the United States.
The flooding.
Not North America. But you have a map of the United States that clearly, you know, depicts certain things, which reminded me of what Edgar Cayce wrote about, because certain parts of California are gone. It's like a string of islands on the west coast. The Mississippi River opens up and widens. And one thing that he said that was very unusual and different from anything that's being predicted right now is that Virginia Beach would rise up, and you showed that on your map. And so I was wondering if you followed any, you don't really quote Edgar Cayce very much, but that map looked like his.
Well, we take a few little clips here and there. We studied his writings, and we, you know, other than what he had written down, we just didn't find any supporting evidence for it. So we have a clip or two from Edgar Cayce, just because he was so profound and such an influence. But some of those maps are actually we have two sets of maps. One is
right.
A set of maps
when
that
you
are
can't read.
Yeah, it's a very poor copy, but it's the best one we get our hands on.
Yeah.
We actually had to license that map. And the other one is actually a USGS future look. If we had tectonic plate activity and we had Arctic and Antarctic cap melting, what would happen to the level of the oceans? So this is, you know, Florida, of course, Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, all those lower states are gone, underwater.
Right.
What's really amazing
is
to look at Arizona. You look at Arizona, you look at New Mexico, look on up into the eastern side of Colorado, and you also see water encroaching into the country, and that's not where a lot of people think that it's going to happen. But there's a fault there called the New Madrid Fault. But the fault in the Afar Triangle did.
I thought that was in the east.
It splits the country right in half. It goes right up the Mississippi River almost. It goes right through Tennessee, goes all the way up into North Dakota.
Okay,
and that fault, when they had an earthquake there in 1836, it made the Mississippi River run backwards and formed the Real Foot Lake, which is still there. So if it does what the Afar Triangle did, and it did it right after we wrote the first volume, we predicted that it would happen, and then it happened while geology students were watching it from a helicopter. And one of the comments was made, gee, we thought this took millions of years to happen, and we watched it happen right in front of our eyes, and it was filling in with the Red Sea. So it could happen pretty quickly.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that you do have new land right off of Virginia in the ocean, and you also have Atlantis rising,
right.
Which I think is very interesting, and that is also according to Cayce. But one thing that I wanted to mention is that Cayce said that the birth of Jesus was actually 4 years earlier, which means that we're in the year 2012, if that's correct.
Yeah, we're in...
This is
2008 is it, isn't it? Well, it's definitely
it
the
is.
Start of it.
And you can certainly see signs of that. But so far in your book, I haven't, and I've also been listening to your,
audiobook.
A download, I guess that's the proper way to say it, I'm with your first book.
Right.
But you do say certain things, but you don't talk about Planet X at all, as your first caller indicated.
Well, we don't call it Planet
books,
X.
You know.
In Sitchin's writings, it's called Nibiru, and Emmanuel Velikovsky also talked about it.
What did he call it?
Well, he just called it Tiamat or Marduk. He had a name for it, and the fact that Marduk struck a planet called Tiamat or Tiamat and shattered it apart, and it was actually the molten core, part of the crust in the frozen ocean of that planet, mm-hmm. that slammed into Earth and possibly created the Pacific Ocean. And for 30 years or so, Emmanuel Velikovsky's book was really ridiculed as bad astronomy. But the last 5 or 6 years, especially, it has gained quite a bit of notoriety in the cosmological scene, because now we are actually witnessing that with the Hubble telescope out in space. We're seeing stars doing exactly what Emanuel Velikovsky wrote about in his book, Worlds in Collision.
It's really fascinating, isn't it? The whole theory of all of it. With your own research, I know with my research that supposedly the Atlanteans did suffer a pole shift, and they had some warning that that was coming on, and that was also at the end in the metaphysical books that I'm reading, or have read. I started reading them really when I was in my 20s. They talked about the fact that that Atlantis' demise actually occurred 25,000 years ago, right between the end of the Piscean Age and the beginning of the Aquarian Age, and that there was a tremendous event. And when I read about it, it said that our planet had a pole star, and that pole star was Polaris, and it was trining with two other star systems, one being Sirius and the other the pointers, Neric and Dubie. And that after this cataclysm, the planet was actually thrown off its axis, and from that date on wobbled in its orbit. So I was reading this around 1979, and I was living in Los Angeles, and I had never heard that before. I remembered that the moon kind of moved like a bell, but I never remembered our planet wobbling in its orbit. And I thought we had a pole star. I thought the North Star was our pole star. So I called the planetarium in Los Angeles, talked to one of the scientists there, told him what I had read, and he said, well, you know, I can't say Atlantis, but there was a tremendous event. We have evidence of the flooding. And he said, our planet does wobble in its orbit. He said, it looks like we're headed toward a pole star. It looks like we're headed toward Vega, but if not Vega, the next star up. And I said, what's the next star up? And he said, Polaris. So my thought was, is that if we fixed on Polaris, that the planet would once again look as it did during Atlantean times. Atlantis would rise, and that part of the west coast that had been underwater, I mean, there's seashells and evidence, you know, and fossil evidence, that that was once underwater, and you talk about that also. Much of the United States had once been underwater. That the planet would look as it did during Atlantean times, and then we would be stable again. It would be a horrific event once again, but we would be stable. And so in about 1971, I attended a lecture series at UCLA in esoteric psychology and met a Dr. Viola Neal, and she had a PhD in physics, and she told me that we were going, at that time, she said, we're going to undergo two polar corrections, and we're hopeful that it will happen slowly. And, you know, I really didn't accept it or reject it. I just kind of held it in abeyance. And then the first sign that I had that that was true was during the Olympics in Los Angeles, which was a decade later. And as the athletes were coming into town, it was embarrassing because it was so smoggy, and the mayor was even apologizing about the smog. And then on the morning of the opening ceremonies, when I woke up, there was no smog to be seen anywhere, and they were talking about it on the news, that it was as crystal clear as could be. It hadn't rained since maybe February, and now it's July, you know, any real rain that would clear the air, and the humidity was up, really up. It felt very humid, and so I thought to myself, well, we just took a dip south. And then they were talking about fish that normally belong off of South America were now off the Santa Monica Pier. And then they started talking about El Nino, El Nina. So I think that we're in the midst of the second of two polar corrections. And
well, it could be. We produced a film two or three years ago called The Horizon Project, and it sales were pretty brisk when it first came out. Then it lulled. And recently I found out that the Ramtha School of Enlightenment bought 600 copies of it and handed it out to their students.
Oh, really?
Here's Ramtha has also, thought about this pole shift, and that film that we did was very well thought out, very well produced by Intuitive Designs, our friends Brent Miller and his son. And if you have a chance to pick that film up, you should do that. It's not very expensive, and it covers exactly that subject.
I'm going to do that, and I did explore that on your website. I've been doing a little research because I was so impressed with your interview on Coast to Coast. And, you know, I bought your book from that interview and everything. But I do think that that's part of this. And I think that as far as Planet X coming in, I think it's just what they talked about. That was Nibiru and Wormwood, and that it's just on its normal course. And I think if people think of the sun as being the nucleus of an atom, they'll understand that, you know, atoms do change. Something can come in and change things. This is just the normal course of things. And what's happening is what needs to happen. It's how planets mature and grow. And it's also how we mature and grow. And hopefully
we become better people
from the experiences.
Maybe we should have the idea that we're involved in this metamorphosis of the Earth, that the fact just another life form, we're not an infestation upon this planet. We are actually supposed to be coexisting with this planet and sharing consciousness with this planet, so that when it goes through its paradisiacal change, we go through it with her.
Exactly. We are connected. We're part of that same life form. Maybe not at the highest level, but we are definitely part of that life form. And it cannot grow without our growing.
Fantastic.
So
I'm going to have to make my way down to Arizona. I know there's a lot going on down there in Sedona, but never been invited to speak down there. Maybe I'll put out some emails or something. I've always wanted to see that area.
I actually live in Prescott, Arizona, which was, it's a mile-high city. It's between 5,500 and 6,000 feet. It was the territorial seat and then the first capital of Arizona. And it's right between Phoenix and Sedona. Sedona has a lower elevation, and we're a little farther west. So we're right in between. And, you know, Prescott has had it's actually a city. It's called the Tri-Cities area. So I think if you came, you know, there's a lot of people who are interested in things in Sedona. But there's also some darkness there and some problems that they've had with the occult. So,
I see.
You know, it goes both ways. So think about that.
Well,
I will. It's just my own opinion. I know there are very good people there, but they've also had other things going on there that are not good.
Well, you know, if we say we're children of the light, then our responsibility is to flood the earth with light. And where there is light, darkness cannot dwell.
I always say that myself. Darkness cannot enter light, but light can enter darkness.
Right.
But these are those times where people are being judged, you know, as to which path they've chosen, and if they're going to go with the spirit of the planet or if they're going to be left behind. And that's just what you said in your book. I think that's what you're saying anyway.
Yes. Yes, and it is possible to change the average consciousness of a universe.
Consciousness of the universe. Well, that would certainly be the source of everything.
Well, the universe is the sum of the consciousness of all the sentient beings in it. So if we change the average consciousness of those sentient beings, shifted the universe, no doubt about it.
Oh, I agree with you, but we have to change in order to change the universe.
Interesting.
I think because we are a part of it, many have said, you know, the last one has to go through the door before he can all move ahead. So I think that the more loving we can be, the more kind we can be, the more helpful we can be, the better. And also to warn people. I think people need to be warned. It really bothers me that, they had in Congress last week a private session that's only happened in 8 times since they've been doing that. And there have been some warnings given. And a little bit is leaking out here and there about what they're warning. It was under the guise of talking about one thing, and then they talked about a lot of other things. But it was a closed-door session, a secret session.
Who was it that spoke to them, or was it just a conversation among themselves?
Well, I think that they, I received something on it today that I can read to you if you'd like, but I don't know if you want it on your station or not. Let me see if I can find it. It has to do with, how they've been talking about the fact, it's Pfizer or Fiker or something like that has to do with going in and, really taking people's, here it is, March 13th, closed-door session. March 31st. The House held a secret closed-door meeting, presumably to talk about the upcoming FISA, F-I-S-A vote. And this is from Huffington Post. It's coming off of that. The House on Friday approved a Democratic bill that would set rules for the government's eavesdropping on phone calls and emails inside the United States. The vote came after House Republicans forced a rare late-night secret session of Congress on Thursday to discuss the bill. It was the first such session of the House in a quarter of a century. The last one was in 1983 on U.S. support of parliamentary operations in Nicaragua. Only 5 closed-door sessions had occurred in the House since 1825. After this meeting, there was a purported leak of what was actually discussed during the meeting. The possibility of martial law within the United States over an economic crash caused by the dropping dollar and the imposition of the Amero as a replacement dollar. And this comes from Deprogram WordPress. On March 13, 2008, there was a secret closed-door meeting of the United States House of Representatives in Washington. And then they go on to say, during the last 182-year history, let me see if I can find the points. Here is what was revealed. 1, the imminent collapse of the U.S. economy to occur sometime in late 2008. The imminent collapse of the U.S. government finances sometime in mid-2009. That was 2. 3, the possibility of civil war inside the United States as a result of the collapse. The next one, the advance roundups of insurgent U.S. citizens likely to move against the government. The next one, the detention of those rounded up at the REX-84 camps constructed throughout the United States. The next thing, the possibility of public retaliation against members of Congress for the collapses. The next, the location of safe facilities for members of Congress and their families to reside during massive civil unrest. The next one, the necessary and unavoidable merger of the U.S. with Canada and Mexico, establishing the North American Union. And then the last one is the issuance of a new currency called the Amero for all three nations as an economic solution. And
kind of interesting that almost every single one of those, almost every single one of those was in our first book. And in the second book, we actually talked in a chapter called The Return of the Watchers. We talked about the unified currency. We talked about the electronic money, and we also talked about the economic collapse in 2008.
And then it goes on. It says Thursday, July 17th, 2008, Texas Congressman Ron Paul has warned the House that he is, quote, convinced the time is now upon us that some big events are about to occur, end quote, that will cause liberty to go, and then, quote, into deep hibernation. And then Paul told the House, quote, these fast approaching events will not go unnoticed. They will affect all of us. They will not be limited to just some areas of our country. the world economy and political systems will share in the chaos about to be unleashed. There are reasons to believe this. This is still his quote. There are reasons to believe this coming crisis is different and bigger than the world has ever experienced. Instead of using globalism in a positive fashion, it's been used to globalize all the mistakes of the politicians, bureaucrats, and central bankers. So you should feel very proud that you foresaw this. And because you know what I think? By your having said it, Brooks, and then people reading it later on, it gives you become more credible. And it also allows them time to think about it. So when they hear it the second time, they hear it and they really hear it. That's the confirmation.
Right.
Kind of like what Dr.
Right.
Neal told me in 1971, and then I started seeing the signs in 1980 and beyond. And it really
they're accelerating,
like
Dottie.
Yourself.
There's no doubt about
you know,
it. Things
really
are
is.
Accelerating, and we better fasten our seatbelts, hadn't we?
I think so, too, but I also, I am upset because I think it's unconscionable if this is the year, the true year of 2012, of 2008, you know, you take away or add those 4 years on from when our calendar started. If we are in the year of 2012, people need to be warned about what's going to happen so that they can make preparations, especially not allowing their children to go to school. You know, to keep the family together, to have a family plan, to do as the Mormons have always done, you know, keep a, you know, a well-stocked
food storage
pantry,
and water storage.
Right.
And
doing
and we,
all
you
of
know,
that.
That's why we had to rush and get the third book out, because all those preparations,
right.
We have two whole chapters on it in there. I almost voted to keep it out of the book, but then I realized, hey, people have to make some physical preparations, and the last part of the book is the personal and perhaps spiritual preparations that you could make to maybe even transcend it. So I'm about 9 minutes over for my break, Dottie. I need to get some commercials in and pay some bills.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, Brooke.
Oh, you've
and,
been a fantastic
best of luck
guest.
To you and all your good... Well, thank you. And I hope you'll let us all know if you come to Arizona. And
well,
think about
I will.
Prescott. If
I will.
Could set something up for you, I would. Okay. Take care.
Well, all right, Dottie. Thanks for the call. Well, one of the things we've learned from our many emails that we get is that there are many listeners to this program who are educators. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you. The Academic Superstore is the place where you can buy software and gadgets and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts, sometimes up to 70% off. And now with school getting ready to start, bargains are hard to find. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared Radio, and you can start saving. You know, the space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. Someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the space store at X Squared Radio. Just click on the banner. Usually free shipping. We were talking earlier about comets and the fact that the Perseids are coming up, and we mentioned that this particular cometary stream left over from many years ago was actually discovered by an amateur with a telescope. And if you've ever thought about owning a telescope, I mean a really good telescope, you need to visit the Discovery Store. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets and asteroids discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. You see, all those big telescopes are contracted for years to come by government and university grants. They're not looking for near-Earth objects. Who knows? You might just save the planet So plan yourself a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. We were also talking about preparation, and Dottie had reminded us that we should be putting some food storage together. Now, I don't necessarily mean buying an extra bag of Captain Crunch and a few cans of soup. Those are kind of hard to pack around, and they don't really hold up well to age or heat of a trunk or in a backpack. But NitroPack, which is our affiliate, has some harvest specials coming out this month. You need to click the NitroPack banner at x2-radio.com and get prepared. They have everything, 72-hour kits, water filters, space blankets, all kinds of hiking gear, things that you need if you're in a hurry and you're on the road. If we do have further economic collapse, and in the news today, federal government approved a bill which will allow foreclosure to refinance their homes with federal underwriting under the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae systems, which are now practically bankrupt. I guess you know that means that we, the taxpayer, are going to be making all those house payments. Also, 28 more banks have hit the failure list. So I don't really know how to advise you to manage your portfolio, but I would say cash is king and liquidity is the smartest way to go. But in the case that you must leave your domicile, the place where you reside, your apartment, your house, your tenement, your condo, and hit the road for relatives over the hill, you want to be able to take that food storage with you. You're not going to get very far pushing it in a wheelbarrow or dragging it in a hand cart down a busy sidewalk. You want to be able to put a 72-hour kit and some basic necessities in a backpack and start walking. NitroPack is the place to go. Just check it out. Do some shopping this summer while you're cruising around different places. We want to make sure that we remember next week I'm going to be at the Tesla Tech Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico, University of New Mexico. If you're down that way or in a couple hundred miles of there, why don't you come by? July 31st to 2nd, we'll be there. And actually, August 3rd, right? Yeah, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, University of Albuquerque. I'll be there with many, many presenters of new energy technology. If you want to find out about it, go to teslatech.info. And if you can't remember that, click on the Tesla Tech banner at X Squared Radio. There will be about 700 of your friends there. And who knows, you might be able to find a way to greatly reduce your utility bills and your fuel bills on your automobile. So this hour, which we have about 35 minutes left of, we'll talk a little bit about new energy. We have had some tremendous inroads in new energy in the last couple of years, but not a real influx of new products in mass production. And the reason is simple. Three words. Access to capital. One of the things that inventors find so difficult to get their hands on is money. They have great ideas. Many of them are active and even retired engineers. I have said that the great ideas, the really revolutionary ideas that can get us out of this global greenhouse mess we're in, are not going to come from the oil companies. They're not going to come from the automotive companies, because they're all about bleeding technology out one drop at a time so they can get every last economic penny out of it from you. That means you're not going to see today's innovations from them for 10 or perhaps 20 years. Like me, you don't believe we have that kind of time. We're up against it, people. The ice is melting, the salinity of the oceans are changing, the weather patterns are changing. It might be from forces out in space, but if it's just a little bit influenced by the activities of man, don't you think we're cognizant and responsible enough race that we could do our part to keep it from going over the edge? I think so. I think you do too. So what can we do? What can the listeners of X Squared Radio do to reverse global warming, to conserve a little bit more, to find new energy sources and help them come to market? Oh, it's way more simple than you might think. Because there are bright people out there who have already thought of the solution. It's here, today. It's sitting in garages and attics, sitting in basements and backyards and engineering labs all over the country. The one thing that keeps that technology from getting from the garage to underneath your hood is money. And the money's not going to come from the federal government. The inventor can't raise it. He, even if he went into manufacturing in his own living room and worked 24 hours a day, he's not going to make enough to make a real impact on the world. Almost to an inventor, they would rather see the technology go into mass production, barely meeting their needs of survival, than they would to keep it a secret until they die. They want to see it proliferate. Well, if it's not going to come from the government, and it's not going to come from their own family savings, that means it's got to come from you. Somewhere along the line, those of us that have a little bit more, a little bit extra, find ourselves the responsibility of a small contribution to someone out there in the field of alternative energy. Find a company. Start with A. Start with the middle of the alphabet, L, or start with Z. Pick a company and start sending them $20 or $30 a month. But listen to this program. We'll do that. We can walk away from this greenhouse trap we've got ourselves into. We can say goodbye to foreign oil forever, and we may not even have to drill off the North Slope of Alaska. In fact, the idea that we are in the 21st century, and yet we are still drilling holes in our planet, digging it, shoveling it into our gas tanks to burn, is Neanderthal. We're beyond that, people. What we have to do is give our brightest minds a hand up. Find them. Invest in them. Consider it a gift. You're probably never going to see a return on your investment anyway, not in your lifetime. But if we can pour a few billion dollars a month into new energy, we can loosen the grip of the energy barons on us, on our taxation, on our planet, and we might be able to walk to a better world. It's up to you. You outnumber them by the billions. So let's get started. Earth, as you know, is approaching a stream of debris from the comet Swift-Tuttle. And this is the source of the annual Perseid meteor showers. Peak August 12th, but they actually start tonight. So if you've got a clear sky tonight, grab yourself something chilled, a pillow. Lay back and watch the sky. Let your pupils open up and see what you can see. You know, oxygen may be the breath of life, but it's not entirely clear how Earth's atmosphere came to be so full of it. Now, researchers in Australia are saying that supercontinents and supermountains played a major role in the process. The oxygenation of Earth's atmosphere is thought to have happened in six or seven steps, starting 2.65 billion years ago and ending about 40 million years ago. Ian Campbell and Charlotte Allen, University of Canberra, say that most of these steps coincide with the formation of supercontinents. Now, they argue that the tectonic collisions that created the Superior Sclavia, Nuna Rodinia, and Gondwana, the Pangaea supercontinents, also formed supermountains, which eroded rapidly, washing into the ocean. This is in contrast with very solid evidence that the Earth's crust has actually expanded to three times diameter. This means that all the continents were once jammed together, a key and a lock, and that as the crust expanded with molten material and thus ocean as it cooled, either way, the nutrient dump resulted in the true supplier of oxygen. The fueled explosions of oxygen-producing algae and also bacteria. Interestingly enough, algae is also the ultimate ancient producer of all on the Earth today. It makes a lot more sense to grow algae and turn it into diesel fuel than it does to drill holes in the planet and burn a polluting version of it. By the way, algae biodiesel is non-polluting, non-hazardous, does not impact the food market, and shows the greatest potential of releasing us from the grip of foreign energy providers. Find a company out there that's changing algae into biodiesel, like our friends down at Green Star. Green Star USA is their website. GSPI is their stock symbol. If that resonates with you, so be it. If not, find another energy company and get involved. Let's talk this hour about some other energy ideas that are out there. Wind is fast becoming a very viable and economically feasible form of electricity generation. Used to be the wind generator technology. The wings were expensive. Manufacturing companies were few and far between. The generators were having problems holding up in severe weather. And lots of wind to get them started to make them economically viable. Now they've got the units down to between 8 generates enough electricity to run a small homestead. And by that I mean a house and a garage and whatever electrical needs you might have for that. 12 to 15 kilowatts, that's quite a bit of electricity. Now, at today's electricity rates, and that's if you're using a Vista or you're using one of the various co-ops around the country that buy power from either nuclear, hydroelectric, or coal-fired power plants, it takes about 4 to 5 years worth of electricity to offset the cost. Think of it another way. You could be paying your average light bill now, assuming that it's not going to go up next year and the year after, if you can safely assume that, and the fact that you know every single time you turn the light switch on, they're going to be there to provide you that electricity. Those are two big assumptions anymore. But assuming those things are stable, in 5 years, you will have paid the electrical company the same amount of money it would cost you to buy a wind generator and all of the supporting circuitry and batteries that goes with it. However, at the end of the 5 years, guess what? Well, you're facing another 5 years of electrical bills, and the guy that has the wind generator isn't. That's one way to think of it. Suppose one of the two assumptions we made don't hold up. What if you throw that switch one day and the lights don't come on because the utility company went bankrupt or because a cataclysm broke the dam or because greenhouse gases have gotten so bad that the federal government has come down on the coal-fired power plant, which, by the way, makes up about 80% of the power we generate in the United States, start shutting those down or curtailing their electrical output So you don't get electricity 24 hours a day. We go on Afghanistan power, 4 or 5 hours a day of electricity. The rest of the day, you're dark. Believe me, people, it's not out of reach. Not out of reach at all. That's one assumption. The other is, suppose something happens to your revenue stream. Your house is paid off, but can't get money to pay that $150, $250 a month, assuming the prices don't change. What if you can't? Exactly. But the wind always blows. There's always enough breeze to keep the lights on. Find a wind generator company and check them out, because now they're becoming so popular and they're being manufactured in such high numbers that the price is coming down. The same thing that happens in every industry when free enterprise and open competition are allowed to flourish, the people demand and set the price for the product. And that's the way it's supposed to happen. Solar technology is coming along. Something that's got a higher watt density. It's not financially feasible for most people. Unless you want to use the solar cells to make just enough hydrogen to fill that tank in your vehicle and drive it for a few hours a week. That might be possible. The only other thing that's out there turning sunshine into energy and two or three easy steps is the algae to biodiesel crowd. And there aren't many people doing that successfully, because although algae grows everywhere, it's the breed that's important, and it's how you grow it. And remember, simplicity is the crown of genius. Complexity, mediocrity. A couple other things we have in our pile of news tonight. Very interesting stuff. There's always more to talk about than we can cover in a three-hour program. Next month, we are going to resume our guest schedule. Because of my time demands up here with the biodiesel plant, we have not had time to put into X Squared Radio the way we want. Our archives have suffered. We changed servers last month, lost our archive database. We greatly apologize for that, but the software is fixed. So if you'll remind us that you have access, just write us an email at sales@x2-radio.com. Just write us an email. Tell us you were a subscriber to X Squared Radio, and we'll fix you up. We're not in it to make money. We just want to pay the bills, keep the lights on. We have a day job. So next month, we're going to be back on our regular schedule with guests. Are comets born in great swarms? The puzzling abundance of comets in short solar orbits has led a pair of astronomers to suggest that they are fragments of larger bodies that crumbled as they entered the inner solar system. Short-period comets take less than 200 years to circle the sun and are thought to originate in the Kuiper Belt of icy objects beyond Neptune. Some Kuiper Belt objects, we call them KBOs, are in vulnerable orbits that allow the gravity of the outer planets to tug them inwards, where the sun's heat turns them into comets. We actually see the ice crystals boiling off the back of the comets, and that's where the tail comes from. However, there seems to be too few KBOs in these vulnerable orbits to maintain the 10,000-strong population of short-term comets, which is continually thinned as they burn out, fall into the sun, or get ejected from the solar system. Well, when Catherine Volk and Renu Malhotra at the University of Arizona in Tucson calculated the rate at which the Kuiper Belt objects should be drawn inwards, their result was just 1/500th of the rate needed. Something was missing from the math, obviously. The disparity would disappear if some of the largest KBOs crumble into 100 or perhaps 1,000 pieces as they are drawn into the inner solar system. The idea is supported by the fact that comets have been seen to of encounters with planets. You'll remember we saw 12 pieces slam into Jupiter just a few years ago. Alternatively, small KBOs in more stable orbits may be so numerous that they contribute the lion's share of comets. A smaller fraction of them are nudged our way. Luke Dones of the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, favors his theory. He says, I know of no evidence in 100 or 1,000 pieces. Well, I'm sure he hasn't lived long enough to see it. But I think they can break in hundreds or even thousands of pieces, and that's why they are so prolific. Not much gravity to hold those together. They're not very dense. Well, we're going to read this one a little differently. Australian motorists have been frightened into greenhouse submission. A shocking CSIRO report issued earlier this month warns of petrol prices of up to $8 a liter by 2018. There are few buttons hotter than the petrol prices to get public attention on the future cost and availability of transport energy. The eye-watering projection of a 500% increase in petrol prices is based on one small section of the Fuel for Thought report, which models a doomsday scenario of imagining if the exhaustion of the world's oil reserves, peak oil, was already upon us. This headline-grabbing analysis by the CICERO curiously eschews mainstream oil demand and supply information, instead relying on data from Peak Oil Netherlands Foundation, which predicts a peak oil in supply in 2010 and a subsequent 3% decline in supply every year thereafter. Not very enlightening, is it? Long before petrol prices could reach $8 a liter, the cost of energy would almost certainly drive the global economy into depression and stabilize the market by collapsing demand. That's the Australian news on energy, in as close to Australian as I can get. Meaning, don't count on 200 years worth of oil, as some lecturers are touting. Even if it was there, getting to it, piping it, getting to the politics of it, and refining it are not easy tasks. Besides, the idea of digging up the planet and pumping it into our gas tanks and burning it is, as I think, short of Neanderthal. In public comment, many people agree with Mr. Friedman's assertion that we must break our addiction to oil, but it is ridiculous and unfounded to claim that the president's response to this challenge consists only of an effort to expand offshore drilling. The president has put forward a series of policies to expand access to our domestic resources, improve energy efficiency, and harness the power of alternative energy. I, for one, have to concede that President Bush has done more for alternative energy than any president in history. Billions and billions of dollars are being funneled into alternative energy, and there are laws on the books in all 50 states now requiring a significant amount of alternative energy to be used in every government vehicle. Tugs, trains, tow motors, buses, barges, all kinds of things that run on diesel fuel now have to run on at least 2% and very soon will be 5% biodiesel. President Bush in November of last year said in 2008 he is requiring 9 billion of alternative fuel, not counting ethanol, to be used in the United States. That demand isn't even close to being met. So we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first line, and where you're calling from, please.
How you doing? It's Ramon from New York.
How are you,
Charlie? I wanted to I'm doing pretty good. I'm listening to the show, enjoying the New York weather. I wanted to ask you to go off the topic you were talking about before. Anything interesting happened at the? I know you were down there. I think it was last week or the week before at James Gilliland's ranch.
Yes.
I know the last time you had a very interesting thing happen to you.
Oh yes, absolutely. We had a new piece of technology there. John Riley brought up an ion generator. He calls this one consciousness. But it is actually a product of Zero Point Research, and it was a portable device he set up out on the field. If you've ever been to the Gilliland Ranch, you know that he's got this huge echinacea field out there beside his hacienda there, and they don't have much light pollution, so you have a great view of the stars. Anyway, we fired up this multi-million volt ion generator, creating a DC magnetic field right above the viewing area. And many people caught this on film, but you could definitely see it with the naked eye. This thing opened up a vortex above us. It went up thousands of feet above us. And we got what we call UFOs. Now, these are unidentified flashing objects. These aren't satellites that are going overhead and just roll over and you see their solar panels flash in the sun. These don't come from anywhere. They're just above you, and they flash very bright, like a super bright headlight several thousand feet up above you. It's really bright. Now, a lot of us were equipped with these little green lasers, you know, the laser pointers that you point out things going overhead, or that way you don't have to have somebody look down your elbow at a star. You could just point at it. We were flashing these things up above into this vortex, and darned if those things weren't flashing back. Now, that was really amazing. We call that a CE5, Close Encounter
flashing
of the Fifth
back
Kind.
Flashing back a different color, or?
Yes, they were flashing back bright white, almost like lightning white, and we were flashing a green argon laser at them. But they were flashing back at the same rate we were flashing them.
That was amazing.
Yeah, really amazing. And somehow this thing made it, this consciousness thing that John Riley brought with him, made it to where orbs were just almost visible. You know how when you take your digital camera and you flash out into the night, if they're there, they'll show up in your camera, right? But they're hard to see with the naked eye, almost impossible. These you could see with the naked eye if you would look up into the flash as somebody was flashing up into the air. You just keep your eyes open, and you could see the orbs with your naked eye. Now, that was amazing.
So, this piece of technology, did it, like, maybe somehow in a certain, like, area bring up the vibration where you're able to see different things, or it opened some kind of wormhole or vortex?
Wow, that's a really good question. We were actually encircled around it, and we formed a Fibonacci spiral. One person with their hand on the machine, and then hand to hand, forming a human spiral going out in a Fibonacci increase. We tried to match that increase as closely as possible. In that circle of people that were holding hands and looking up, hardly a person did not have an amazing experience, some kind of feeling of elation with this. But the visible effects, for those of us standing outside this circle looking at that event, it was as though a vortex was being opened up. I won't say a wormhole, but it was definitely a vortex of visible energy that you could see.
That's amazing. I just wish I was there to see that.
Mihal Ledwith was there, and he is for all intents and purposes, he's probably the foremost orb expert in the world. And there are a lot of people that are up there with him as far as numbers of orb pictures. But he's done the best job at explaining them and showing the different kinds of shapes and behaviors. And he's a very enlightened individual. If you ever get a chance to hear Michal Ledwith speak, don't pass it up, because you'll be entertained, you'll be enlightened, and you'll be educated. But he was there, and even he made comments about how special the connection was with the energies that are normally present there at the in Trout Lake, Washington.
Now, my question about the system technology again, since you're saying that you formed a chain, that's almost like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's almost like maybe like wiring it, like, because we can pass electricity through our body. So, did it, because there was conscious wires, basically, for lack of a better word, did that probably not have what caused the experience? Do you understand my question?
I think that the two were necessary, because I've been there 2 years prior without the consciousness there, without the zero-point research equipment there. And although it was a very special experience, and we always see some kind of unidentified flying craft over there, this was very intense, and I think the combination of the human wiring and the zero-point research technology was very profound. It's something we definitely want to try again.
Hmm. And my last question to you was, the last time me and you spoke, which was probably over a month ago, you were telling me about, I don't know if you remember our conversation, we were having a conversation about certain, like, telepathic thoughts that we hear, like, in between sleep, and how you had heard a certain name, and I said, oh, that's the same name that, according to Billy Myers, said that meant a certain thing. Do you
right.
remember?
Yes, we were talking about...
I was wondering if you did... Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of that.
Oh, no, I was going to say, were you able to find anything out about it? Did you have a chance to do any research on it?
You know, I have not. I wanted to, but my day job is I'm wrapping this plant up here in eastern Washington State, and unfortunately is taking so much of my time. I can't say unfortunately, because I really, really enjoy what I do. But it has cut down on my research time, and that's something that I do want to research, because it seems like, you know, perhaps since I was a young boy, these kinds of experiences have been happening, and for most of my life I just set them aside because they're impractical. But now I'm to a point in my life where they're becoming very important to me, and I'm paying more attention to them. Or the listeners to do the same thing. If you are having dreams or visions, you need to pay more attention to them, because as we get closer to this gravitational plane of the Milky Way galaxy, perhaps some of our, I don't know if it's our DNA or if it's our consciousness, but something inside us is beginning to become more telepathic, more aware. And these higher beings are maybe going to be facilitated in communicating with us. So let's leave the lines of communication open.
I'll tell you this last story. I've been practicing this, it's like a type of meditation, where you draw out like a square, a black square, and put it up against like a white surface, a white plain surface. And you do a meditation at first, like to silence the mind and relax yourself, and then you open your eyes and you look at it for about 10-15 minutes, trying not to blink. And what I've noticed, you start to see like almost another square, but from my experience, like a theist there.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why I found out about the sex toys, I was doing research on the third eye, and I was listening into a couple of things on YouTube from David Wilcock, where he talks a lot about the third eye.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that my dreams have become way more vivid. And sometimes I even see, like, these clear squares, like, up against the wall, kind of, like, shifting around. But then I'm trying to make sense of it, but I'm like, let me not just make sense. Let me just be the observer and not try to analyze anything while I'm talking to the journey.
So you say there's a geometric shape in your vision, and it looks like a square. Do you think it could be a tetrahedron on its end?
So far from what I've seen, is just a plain square. As far as when I'm looking at it during the meditation, like I'm looking at the black square, it sometimes looks like a cube, and then sometimes it goes from clear to like a semi-reddish color.
Uh-huh.
But if I lose focus of it, like if I shift my eyes in any way, it'll go away real fast.
Well, have you tried asking it to turn clockwise or clockwise and see what kind of energy field it can create?
No, I haven't.
One of the things we do in the Merkaba meditation is we try to match the physics of the shape. In other words, when we talk about black holes, we know that they're spinning very, very quickly. The one that's in the center of our galaxy, even though it's got 400 million suns worth of matter in it, it does a complete revolution in about 11 minutes. So that's a lot of energy, a lot of spin. And what happens in nature, at least in physics, energy doesn't just sit there static, it spins. So if we can use our consciousness to put a spin on that geometric shape, you might be able to, you might be surprised at the kind of energy you can create.
I'll definitely try that one. Really quickly on what you just said, I saw a video on YouTube where David Sarita actually talked about the black holes and the spinning, and
uh-huh.
He believes that that's how a lot of these flying saucers are getting from one point to another, that they do that to be, I guess, the atoms of the ship in order to get it lighter, to get it turning from matter into energy, and that's how they're able to traverse the ether.
Well, when he and I get together, we kind of talk about that a little bit. He believes that spacecraft can negotiate their way around the universe that way, and I don't have any argument with that. I make the assertion that even planets can move around the universe and perhaps even between dimensions using the same kind of the shape of a massive spinning black hole is open for argument, even in the modern physics community. Do they stay round? Do they flatten out like a dinner plate? There's as many supporters in one camp as there is another, but both camps believe that Einstein and Rosen had the right idea, that a spinning black hole can actually open up a win-win wormhole, an area where gravity will allow a body to move through time relative to the outside universe without really aging.
That would actually make sense to me. So,
it's pretty cool conversation.
So, if a planetary body can do this, then like a physical human body should be able to do that as well.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, if ships can negotiate that kind of stuff, if they know their coordinates as they go through these things, I think it would take a lot of trial and error, and if you sent somebody to the future, you'd never know it. But if you send somebody to the past, you could probably figure it out by looking in the history books. I think it can be done. but I think it takes a lot more knowledge and power than we're going to have in our generations.
I don't know. I personally feel like we already have that knowledge and power. It's kind of you having a book that teaches you all these different things and just never pick it up and read it. So you say that you don't really have it, but it's sitting right in front of your desk. You just never open the page.
Yep, I'm with you.
Well, we'll see what happens. All right, thank you very much.
Welcome. Call back anytime.
Thank you.
All right, Earth Explorers, that's second hour in the can. Remember, this is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, let someone know down at bbsradio.com, and we'll get with your affiliate and make sure that you can get all 3 hours in your neighborhood. We like it that you're listening on the computer because that means you're sitting there with an internet connection and a credit card in your hand. Makes you the most powerful listeners on the planet. Too bad the fellows that advertise on radio can't figure that out. Listeners to BBS Radio, which you should know is by all accounts the number one internet radio network in the world, bar none. The quality of hosts over the years that are accumulating here is not only supporting a labor of love by our wonderful producer, Don, but also fulfilling their own dreams of reaching you, the listener, with their message. Last month, and we are humbled to the dust that you've done this, but last month more of you went to BBS Radio through our website at X Squared Radio than anyone else, and we appreciate it. It's a big help for us. I don't know if you know this or not, but 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts. It's true. Well, now the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor if you've got an Eagle Scout coming up. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how that we are returning to the moon. All you have to do is visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Also, there is some place you should visit before the end of next week. At x2-radio.com at the very bottom, and also at arcofmillionsofyears.com at the very bottom, there is a red banner called the Horizon Project. It's probably the most important examination of future Earth events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon, and I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that this first DVD in the six-part series is available, and you can purchase it at $5 off if you use that banner. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important purchases you ever make. So click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. Pick up your copy of that DVD. Our friends Brent Miller and his son down there at Intuitive Design. And we thank you very, very much for the skyrocketing sales of the Arc of Millions of Years Volume 3. We went up into the top 100 on Amazon, which is pretty darn good for a self-published book, and you're pretty much keeping it there, and we appreciate that. It reads very well. We have a new cover artist, Roy Young, who has done a great job for us, and he has redesigned Volumes 1 and Volume 2. We have the new cover art, and we're going to be uploading it to the website so that you can see it. But now it's a matched set. All three books have very similar bordering and excellence in clarity of the artwork. It'll really make a neat addition. And if you haven't already, buy it for a friend. You can do that two ways. You can, of course, buy online at any of the places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, eCampus, all of those places carry it. You can go down to your local bookstore and buy it, or you can order it from arkofmillionsofyears.com. That's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark. And we'll send it to you autographed. And if you buy Volume 3 for seven more days, we will send you the audio version of Volumes 1 and 2. We have those ready on our website. They're a download. They're MP3s, so you can save them to your hard drive. You can put them on your iPod, your MP3 devices. We tried to make each cut about an hour long, so if you even want to burn them to CDs, you can listen to them in your car if you like. We're giving those first two books away to you in audio because we want you to have the information. That's a $40 value as a bonus if you'll pick up the third volume in hard copy. That way you can catch up. There's about 1,500 pages there. If you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. We read the first two books for you. So you'll have all three of those, and all you have to do is read one. Now, in covering 2012 and all of the cataclysmic events leading up to it, we realized after about 1,200 pages that the ancients and even modern science had painted a picture of doom and gloom. And normally, my co-author E.J. Clarke and I blend our writing styles rather seamlessly through the books so that you kind of get, you know, the meat of the subject along with some artistic flair. But in the final book, we decided to have a part one and part two. Part one of the book finishes the trilogy with all of the ancient 2012 end times information. And believe me, if you're learning series of books that have all of the information, the ones predicted to come forth as the end times books, you found them. There are lots of wannabes out there, lots of people that have one or two sources. We have over 50 sources that we used to accumulate this research, not including the scientific data, absolute cutting-edge physics. A lot of it is still in abstract form and hasn't even been released to the public yet. Part two of the final book is the tools that you need to unlock the law of attraction for yourself. You know that, just a little over a year and a half ago, a book hit the market called The Secret. It was written by Rhonda Byrne and enjoyed a phenomenal marketing plan, probably the most successful marketing plan ever in the self-help genre. And it sold a lot of copies and it awakened a lot of people, but it did not give you the tools that you need to work the law of attraction. Believe me, sticking a picture of something on your refrigerator with a magnet is not enough. Writing yourself a blank check for $1 million is not enough. These are the tools that you need to work the law of attraction. This is a way of moving the average consciousness of the universe in a positive direction. We believe that the universe is the sum of all of the consciousness of all the sentient beings in it. If we have a way, or we are successful in elevating the consciousness of a significant portion of those sentient beings, we have shifted the average consciousness of the universe. That means we have created a new universe. We might be able to even change or alter or soften or enlighten the cataclysms that are coming. This is a message of hope in Volume 3 of The Ark of Millions of Years. This book is called Unlocking the Secret. It is now in print and climbing the charts. We want you to know your potential is absolutely unlimited. You can get it to millionsofyears.com, or you can buy it at the online store at X-Squared Radio, x2-radio.com. Don't want this hour to go by without telling you about our friends down at NRG Resources. We've introduced a new engine oil technology. Its code name now is TVT-247. It is the future of lubrication. This is the lubrication industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. I just heard a story day before yesterday of a young man who had bought a foreign car used. He put TVT-247 in the manual transmission. He noticed, after he filled the transmission with oil, that there was an oil slick under the vehicle. Deciding anyway, 100-mile trip in the summer, he arrived at his destination, noticed the transmission was shifting just a little bit hard, took it to a transmission shop. They drove it around the parking lot, said, that's just the way that transmission works. Don't worry about it. It's normal. And he said, no, I really think you need to put it up on the rack because I want you to look at it. It just doesn't seem to be shifting right to me. They put the car up on the rack, and they noticed a walnut-sized hole in the side of the case. The previous owner had hit something, knocking a hole in the bottom of the manual transmission. There was no oil in the manual transmission. Well, needless to say, the transmission shop said, "Where did you drive from? You drove 500 miles in this? Why don't we have a 5-gallon bucket full of gears and shredded metal in the bottom of this thing?" And he said, "Well, it's because I put TVT-247 in the manual transmission." That's right. It reduced the friction to nothing. It impregnated the iron in the transmission and kept the gears from getting hot and wearing on each other. You've heard in the news that they're drilling the deepest hole in the world in Russia. Well, in order to drill that hole, you have to suspend 40,000 feet of drill pipe on a Kelly. That's a big brake that holds that stuff from going slamming down into the hole and allows the hole to be drilled. Well, when you're putting that much drill steel together, threading it together, it has a tendency to stick. In other words, you can't get it unscrewed if you ever try to pull it out. All those threads have been lubricated with TVT to make sure that drill rod will come apart. That's how the deepest hole in the world is being drilled. That's how the gearbox stayed together. And that's how your engine will stop wearing. Pick up TVT 24/7 by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio. In this hour, we want to talk about China's photographing of the moon. You'll remember back in November of 2007, but released a comprehensive photograph. These are strips about 2,500 feet wide, fairly high resolution strips stitched together. Single large picture of the moon. Well, some dogged sleuthing by a fellow space blogger has tracked down the truth behind the controversial first photo from China's moon orbiter. In the week since the picture was released and much fanfare in Beijing, there has been widespread rumor the photo was a fake, copied from an old picture collected by a U.S. space probe. I guess they didn't pick up the fact that this one was about 1,000 times the resolution of the old space photo. But there was something new in the photo that wasn't there before, a crater. The Chinese said, well, I guess we've discovered a new crater. Well, turns out that's not the case. The good news for the Chinese is that the Planetary Society blogger, Emily Lakdawala, clears them of outright fakery. The bad news is she found the evidence that the photo was badly retouched for public release. Photo analysts found that a mistake was apparently made in stitching together the 19 strips of imagery to produce the finished picture, and that Chinese officials unknowingly pointed out that mistake as they defended the photo's veracity. The mission's chief scientist, Aowang Ziyang, told the Beijing News that a new crater had imagery, a crater that didn't appear on the U.S. imagery. Well, Lakdawala determined that crater in question, it wasn't exactly new. Instead, it appeared to be a crater that had been moved from one spot on the picture to another spot slightly south. She says, you know, that there should have been seams in that image, and I just did not look for them carefully at the time. Just how high resolution is the Chinese mapping program, and how much detail of the surface of the moon is being released? One thing's for sure, and I want to talk about it in this last half hour. After the November 2007 release, we have not seen another frame from the Chinese. What do you suppose is up there? Do you think there's something on the far side of the moon? Interestingly enough, the Chinese probe that's up there going around the moon taking strips of photographs does so 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and all that imagery is being sent to China directly. We don't know what they're finding. You do a search on the net, you won't find it either. Nobody is getting that video feed. So this hour, give us a call. All the phone lines are open. We'll be here for about another 35 minutes in the U.S. toll-free 888-228-94. In Canada, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet, off planet, or if you're using the new Magic Jack, as we are tonight, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. And don't forget, if you're using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio, and you Pal Talk users can reach us at BBSRadio_com. How much do the Chinese know? Are they telling us all the information from that lunar probe? If you know the answer, you've got a way to hack into that Chinese feed, we want to talk to you tonight. Also, if you have any kind of imaginations, what might be up there. We have heard from former astronauts who have orbited the moon. As you know, the far side of the moon is invisible from Earth because it faces away from us all the time. The far side of the moon is far more dense than the side that faces us, so it is slung away from us and remains so. As the moon very slowly goes around the Earth, it also revolves at exactly the same rate on its own axis. So we only see the same side of the moon, whether we're experiencing a lunar eclipse or not. So the other thing that people notice about, if you look at the far side of the moon and the near side of the moon, is the fact that the far side of the moon is 6 times brighter than the side of the moon that faces us. Especially in 1970s music as the dark side of the moon, but that is far from the case. Actually, the dark side of the moon faces us. The dark side of the moon is coated with a thin layer of iron, or it could be some other dark mineral. But the far side of the moon does not have this coating. And so when it's the full moon facing out away from us, it is six times brighter. It reflects six times more energy back out into space. It's also covered with many, many more smaller craters, more frequent craters, and deeper craters than the side that faces us. One of the interesting things about the dark on the side of the moon facing us is it's evidence that it didn't happen too long ago, perhaps 20 or less. I'll let you know how significant that is in about 3 minutes, but it's an event called the Black Axiom, and we talk about it in the first volume of The Arc of Millions of Years. It is an event where when the solar system passes through the galactic plane, and I mean by L-A-N-E, it is sort of like a thin piece of glass, very intense gravity that's emitted or collected or focused by the massive spinning black hole in the center of our galaxy. As the solar system passes through this, it is a region, not very thick, mind you, that is packed with dense, hard matter, like dark matter. It's a cloud, but it's concentrated in a flux line that emanates from the massive spinning black hole in the center of our galaxy. We're about to pass 4 years, five at the most, we're going to pass through this cloud. Now, the fact that the Earth spins relatively quickly on its axis means Earth is going to get an even coating of whatever it is we pass through. Some of these little pellets might be the size of a grain of sand, making a really nice shooting star in the sky, and others of it might be the size of a marble, a baseball, or a Volkswagen. In any case, these are going to become whizzing through our atmosphere at about 18,000 miles an hour. I wouldn't want to be standing in the field when one of these things comes cracking down through the atmosphere at Mach 7. That being said, the moon revolves very slowly, once every 28 days. So half of it is going to get coated, just like it did 26,000 years ago. Interesting how all this comes together. Oh, by the way, the reason we know it didn't happen too long ago is because when we look at the moon, we don't see any large white crater spots on the moon. If that black axiom coated the side of the moon facing us, and there was a significant crater event on the moon, you would see a large white hole where the white dust of the moon would be blown out onto the dark surface. Those large areas are missing, which means that's not been there that long. One of the other things we want to cover this hour, if you don't want to talk about what's on the moon, is human DNA. It turns out that we've been covering the Human Genome Project from just about every angle, and now they're asking the question, can we tweak certain genes to stave off the aging process, or conversely, to speed it up? New research indicates that it may be possible. Scientists have discovered genetic switches in roundworms, also very closely related to some former bosses that I've had, whose genetic makeup is remarkably similar to that of humans. That apparently caused the spineless critters to grow old when flicked on, but when off, extends their lives. This is a new and potentially powerful circuit that has just been discovered. The take-home message is that aging can be slowed by manipulating signaling circuits within cells. By the way, the signaling circuit probably exists in the cell wall, not in the cell nucleus. The new finding challenges the prevailing theory of aging, which is that our bodies wear out or rust, in much the same way as cars and other machines do to damage inflicted on our cellular DNA. by factors such as smoking, disease, the sun's ultraviolet rays, you know, alcohol, exhaust fumes, and chemically reactive molecules called free radicals, which are produced when our cells make energy. It suggests instead that a combination of factors is at play, that in addition to rusting, there are also certain genes that may carry instructions to start the aging process. Stanford University School of Medicine biologist Stuart Kim, who co-authored the new study published in the journal Cell, says the results may explain why species have different lifespans. For example, worms can live up to 2 humans stick around for an average of 66 years, 78 years in the U.S., I think 200 years in here in eastern Washington state, and tortoises can lumber along for around 200 years. His theory, there are certain master genes tasked with directing and maintaining body functions. These genes make proteins called transcription factors that influence the activity of other genes by switching them on or off. According to Kim, these master genes are programmed to shift gears, that is, to make either more or less of these transcription factors, which in turn changes the function of their charges, jump-starting the aging process. We affectionately call this the granny gear. Kim believes that it is possible to slow or even reverse senescence if scientists can figure out how to keep the master genes from changing course. He asked the question, what we found was this developmental regulatory system that keeps worms young had become unbalanced in old age. Kim studied the activity of all 20,000 genes in worms from the time they were about 3 days old, that's about 20 years in human lifetime, until they were 18 days old, which is about 80 to 90 human years, which is when most of them died. As the worms aged, researchers observed changes in the level of activity of more than 1,200 genes, with some turning on and others switching off. Most of these genes are controlled by a transcription factor made by the gene ELT3. So if you're looking down your human genome code, that's the gene to look for, which is known to be involved in the development of roundworms, skin, and intestines. Over time, ELT3 began to shut down, and its transcription factor production waned. According to Kim, the ELT3's shift was caused by the increased activity of two other genes, ELT5 and ELT6, also involved in skin and intestine development. Kim likens ELT5 and ELT6 to brake pedals and ELT3 to the accelerator in a car. As the brakes are applied and exert greater force, the car decelerates, and several genes that depend on the gas pedal for cues on how to behave stop functioning properly. What this means, in layman's terms, is that up until about the age of 40, our genes operate in a way that allows every single cell in the human body to keep itself in relatively perfect health. Obviously, when we're 40, we don't have the same skin elasticity or the ability to bounce back from exercise the way we did when we were, say, 20. Now, why is that? We're the same genetic makeup that we were when we were 20, but certain genes have begun to turn off, or, as Dr. Kim is saying, some genes are beginning to turn on, which are causing us to age, slowing down this ability to replicate. And you might notice that as adults get back in their youthful form, they replicate older and older as we get older. They lose their elasticity. They lose their ability to maintain blood vessel walls, to be able to heal quickly. Well, all of the genetics are there, people, for that to go back the way it was when you were young. As we get closer to this area in the center of our galaxy, this very thin, very intense, frequency-laden layer of gravity that's laid down by the supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy, might have an effect on DNA. It might have an effect on the genetic workings of our body. Genes that have been asleep generation after generation, perhaps millennia after millennia, but are nonetheless still stuck in our genetic code, could not have evolved here. Absolutely could not have evolved here, because we do not have factors that would require their evolution. They've been passed down from generation to generation until now. Now, that junk DNA, that extra DNA that most of us are stuck with, is going to begin switching on. What kind of abilities are we going to have? Are we this telepathic race we talked about last week? Are we able to transcend? Are we able to ascend? Is the translation spoken about by prophets and sages of old possible? Are we going to be changed from mortal beings into immortal beings in the twinkling of an eye? And is this necessarily a good thing or a bad thing? In the next 17 minutes, let's talk about it a little bit. Our phone lines are open, U.S., toll-free, 888. 228-4494 in Canada, and we have a lot of listeners and a lot of book buyers in Canada, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet, off planet, if you're using the new Magic Jack, this is the best way, 530-776-5154. Or 530-776-5185. And we haven't forgot about our Skype users. You can reach us at BBS Radio. And Pal Talk users, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. Roughly 16 minutes left on X Squared Radio, July 27th. Don't forget, if you just tuned in our last hour, Tesla Tech Conference coming up this coming Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. I'll be there along with several dozen other speakers and presenters. There will also be most of the latest energy technology, not only conservation technology, but new generation technology is going to be presented there. If you're within driving distance, 3 or 4 hours away, make your way down to the University of New Mexico this coming Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. Bring your book. I'll sign it while you're there. If you bought it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or one of your local bookstores, if you bought it at our website, you already got it autographed. Our website for the book is arcofmillionsofyears.com. That's ARK, like Noah's Ark. Or you can buy it from the online store at x2-radio.com. Next week, we will be running an archive. I will select that show that we're going to archive for your information during the week, so it will be a surprise. Might have back on Dr. Ronald Mallett, inventor of the latest time machine, and let him tell you about how time travel is now possible. If you have any questions, you can always reach us at info@x2-radio.com. We're always here for you. And I try to get to every single email. Now, I know several thousand of you wrote me in the last 3 weeks because of our appearance on Coast to Coast. That's fine. I try to get to every single one. Might take me 10 days, but those of you that have received answers from me know I'm telling the truth. As we're talking about the moon, and what could be on the far side of the moon, you know, there has been lots of speculation about what might be on the far side of the moon. Moon bases, aliens, the fact that the moon might even be hollow. Let's see if we can get a little insight. We have a caller on the line. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hey, Brooke. Hey, this is Tom from Winston.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Oh, awesome.
What I wanted to talk about was not the moon, but like the Tesla stuff you were talking about.
Yeah.
I had a naturopathic doctor come into my office a month ago, and he brought in this machine that is an electromagnetic impulse machine. Have you ever heard anything like that?
Oh, yeah. My friends down at Zero Point Research have a rotating DC magnetic field. It's not an AC. It's
right.
Really based on the Tesla technology, but go ahead.
Right. Okay. Well, they claim Tesla, but whatever. I had this done to me a month ago, and I had some low back and some ankle problems. And with one treatment of this, it completely took away all my pain. And I had energy like you wouldn't believe for like a week after that. And you know how you're just talking about the DNA and you know how that can change possibly with this. Thing, the Milky Way coming up. And I was just wondering if, you know, with this electromagnetic stuff, if that is actually changing our DNA.
Well, I don't know that it's changing the DNA, but there's definitely something happening here. You see that the human body, each little cell is like a little electric battery, and over time the battery gets low, and then when that cell dies and has to reproduce, it reproduces at the lower voltage. What that machine did when you were exposed to it, you actually put into the field. Now, did he put his hand on the machine and then put his hand on you, sort of streaming the energy into you?
No, it had, it was plugged into the wall. It went from AC to DC, and then he had, like, these coils that he put around you, you know, like a smaller coil around your ankle or a bigger coil around your midsection and just ran like, you know, 3,000 to 11,000 volts through the coil. And you could actually kind of feel it. I mean, it wasn't zapping or nothing, but you could definitely feel the force going through you. And he left it on there for about 12, 15 minutes at a time. And it was pretty remarkable. And
well, I know that there's been research called deep brain stimulation, where they've actually drilled holes in the brain and they insert an electromagnetic coil down into the brain and then they energize the coil. And what these patients, and most of them are Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease, they almost to a person report memories from when they were kids. Coming alive, smells and bright colors and all of the memories that they had when they were young. There's really strong evidence that sitting in these magnetic fields, just like what you're talking about, these very low frequency fields, DC if you can get it, re-energizes the body. And the interesting thing about it, you said the effects lasted for about a week or maybe more. If you do this every other day, if you do it every other day for a month, you'll find that you'll have permanent changes to you.
Right, right. That's what he was saying. But my question about that is, you know, as, you know, like back in the days of, you know, Noah and Moses and all them people, you know, they supposedly lived longer. And I just wonder if, you know, since our electromagnetic force around the Earth is decreasing over... You know, as we age, the Earth ages. I just wonder if, you know, the electromagnetic current was so strong back then that it allowed them to regenerate their tissues and stuff and just last longer.
Excellent point. I like it. Yeah, definitely. The Earth's magnetic field having an effect on the longevity of human life upon her. And as she goes through cataclysms, and certainly the flood of Noah would be a cataclysm, maybe Earth's magnetic field changed thus not protecting or not rejuvenating the human cellular structure to live very long lives.
And maybe that's possibly what's coming up.
Well, I kind of like the idea that now there's technology out there, either through your friend, if you want to mention it on the air, that's fine with me, or through, you know, one of these other technologies, even Zero Point Research. There's technology out there if you want to reverse aging and stave off these debilitating effects from old age. This just might be the ticket.
Yeah. Now, when you were out on the ranch, and you turned that big ionizer on, that, you know, used all those voltage, the high voltage. Did
right.
you guys feel anything from that?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Did you feel differently after that?
We've measured it with a magnetometer. That particular unit puts a magnetic field out about 22 feet. What we were doing is actually putting a hand on the unit and then joining hands in a Fibonacci spiral around it. So the current was going through all of us and, of course, through our feet to ground. Everybody in that circle could feel the energy from this unit.
Well, did you have any lasting effects?
Well, sure. The effects last, for a couple of weeks. We were hooked up to it for the better part of an hour. And that's really amazing. Now, this unit, he calls it consciousness. He uses it in a clinic, in a clinical setting with large groups of people. He has much, much smaller units that you could use in groups of one or two or five, but these are made for fairly large gatherings. The key is the frequency of the rotation of the magnetic field. Now, that is proprietary, but it does key into the resonant frequency of the Earth and the biosystems, and it took him a long time to find that frequency, and it's not adjustable. He tries to actually lock it in.
Now, with that vortex that got created, could that have anything to do with scalar waves at all?
Well, that's a really good point, too. Scalar waves are these extremely low-frequency waves, you know, long-standing waves. It could be. It didn't seem to have that kind of shape. It looked more conical. It came out of the top of the unit, which is about 6 feet tall, and it went straight up into the night sky. I don't know. It probably went up endlessly, but it looked like 1,000 feet. One thing's for sure, it kind of acted like a beacon to whatever flashing objects we were seeing above the ranch.
Have you read anything about the scalar waves, what they can do with high power?
Well, yes.
Blanketing areas, things like that.
I was part of a film documentary back in 1997 called Angels Don't Play This Harp. Actually, the documentary was called Holes in Heaven, and it was produced by Wendy Robbins, and or it was directed by Wendy Robbins, and Nick Begich and I were in it, and Pat Flanagan and some other scientists. This is a weapon system that the Navy has on the North Slope of Alaska, and they use scalar waves to push the ionosphere around, and it can be rather dangerous. They're using 1 billion watts up there.
Yeah, I've read that. Where they can kind of control the weather and things like that.
Well, yeah, as it turns out, when they push the ionosphere out into space, and they can push it 50 to 80 miles out into space, it creates a void which is filled in with the stratosphere, which moves the jet stream, which can be used to control the weather. And although they signed a treaty during Clinton's presidency to not use it as a weapon, the evidence seems to be out there that perhaps they have used it.
Well, I've read where Russia actually came up with it, and they use it to kind of goof up each other's technology as we progress. I don't know if you've heard anything about
Well, Dr. Eastland is the inventor of the HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. That's the long name of it. And shortly after he published his findings and his 7 patents that go with it, the Russians built one and the Chinese built one. They're affectionately called ionospheric heaters. So, the 3 major powers are using them, and supposedly we have an agreement not to use it to manipulate each other's weather.
Right. Now, I've read also where it can actually penetrate through the Earth. Is that true?
Yes, you can reflect waves off the ionosphere, bounce them back into the Earth, and pick them up on the other side, or even in reflections of it, and actually X-ray the Earth. Now, not X-ray in the sense of high-frequency X-rays, but in the sense that you get kind of a radiogram, an MRI of the Earth. If you have a way to image that, you could probably find major oil finds and other things in the Earth. That's the way I used to look for oil back in the 80s. Using very low wattage, of course, this was shallow stuff, 3,000 to 6,000 feet. And now, of course, the Russians are drilling the deepest hole on the Earth, and ostensibly they located it using this technology.
How deep is that hole supposed to be?
The reports are just over 40,000 feet. It's about 17,000 feet further than any other hole drilled. I understand they're drilling for oil, and some reports are that they have struck oil. Now, how in the world they're going to pump it 8 miles to the surface is yet to be seen, but I do know that they are drilling and actively trying to bring that well online.
Now, you know, when you talk about your the expedition to the inner Earth, do you explain that Bell theory on how they read that seismic graphing, how that?
Well, in 1996, when the internet, you know, really became viable for the public, the government had been using it for a long, long time. When I was in the service in the early 70s, we had a thing called the Watts line. It was sort of a local toll-free network that we could, you know, link all the bases together. And when it was made public, they began linking these USGS stations together real-time. So whenever there's a heavy earthquake on one side of the planet, the vibrations go through the planet and are picked up by a network of geophones or accelerometers around the planet, and you get kind of a CAT scan, a low-frequency scan of the planet. Unfortunately, not many people around to actually look at the seismograms. So there were a couple of universities, Washington University, under the direction of Dr. Y. Sessions, went through 600,000 seismograms and came up with some remarkable analyses showing another ocean underneath the Atlantic Ocean. And the Japanese recently released a study that the core may actually be a solid crystalline iron core, and there does appear to be a void between that and the crust. Pretty interesting stuff from someone who's interested in the hollow Earth.
So is that all coming together pretty good?
Well, of course, the science team, we just sent our ad calling for papers to the Geological Society of America. It will come out next month. They will have their convention in September. We're asking for scientists from all over the world, geologists from all over the world, to join our team. We are accepting abstracts up until November 1st, and then we will go through those and select the science team from those groups. And, of course, we're accepting grants and sponsors from the universities who want to get their scientists on the ship. It would be a fraction of the cost for them. If they wanted to make this trip on their own, it would cost them $1 million. We're giving them away for a couple of scientists to make it for less than $50,000. So it's a great deal for them, and it adds a great scientific strength to our team as well.
Now, as far as that, the Yamal, right now it's the is the Arctic Ocean up there? I mean, is it pretty open? I mean, if it was open, wouldn't that open up to other ships too?
Well, it does. I mean, you still have to have an icebreaker to get through, even in the summertime. And there are diesel-powered icebreakers that can make it, but not for a 15-day trip. Yeah, it's a long way. We tried ones from Alaska. We tried ones from Russia. We just can't get any that can go that far. They can make it to the North Pole, but they just can't make it to the other side of the Arctic Circle.
Because I was just under the impression that there wasn't quite that much ice up there.
Well, there is. In toward August, it forms at the rate of between 10 and 50,000 acres a day, and it refreezes every winter. Well, listen, Tom, we are out of time with X Squared Radio, but I need you to call back again. Next week, we're going to run an archive, so don't call back then, but in 2 weeks, we'll be back on with our regular schedule. And we're glad that you called in, and keep calling in. You have the best questions.
All right, well, I appreciate it. Have a good night.
All right, thanks, Tom. Well, that is it, Earth Explorers. We come to you each week from 5 to 8 p.m. Pacific Time. We try to bring you the best 3 hours of scientific talk radio on the planet. We might go a little past your imagination, but that's okay. We'll bring you back home safely. If you're listening to us while you're at your workstation on your favorite project Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday of next week, have a productive week. Try to look for the good in others and help bring it out. Before long, you will change the planet. Don't forget, you are Source. This is X Squared Radio saying peace, Earth Explorers.